It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, the Republican Party is coming home tonight for its fourth primary debate. According to most accounts, the party was founded in Ripon, Wisconsin in 1854. We'll check out that history.
First, a federal appeals court ruled yesterday that President Obama overstepped his legal bounds with his executive order meant to protect 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation.
The ruling is a blow to the president in his efforts to fulfill promises to institute meaningful immigration reforms. Today, the U.S. Department of Justice announced they'll appeal that ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Joining us to talk about the president's immigration reform plan and the court battle surrounding it is Alan Gomez. He's an immigration reporter at USA Today. Alan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So why did the federal appeals court say they were blocking the president's executive action on immigration?
Two things. One of them is a bit procedural. They're saying that the administration did not go through the proper period of public comment that it needed to do to institute such a massive rule. But the bigger issue, and I think the one that we're going to hear a lot about as this thing makes its way up to the Supreme Court, is the basic question whether the president has the authority without any congressional approval to institute a plan this big to protect that many undocumented immigrants. And that's where the judges ruled that he had overstepped his bounds and that in order to do that, he needed some sort of congressional approval. So that's why they maintained a block on this program, and it'll stay there until and if the Supreme Court decides to take up the case.
Sounds like one of the sticking points here is the use of prosecutorial discretion in this case. Now, what has the president had to say about how he was using it?
Exactly, and that's exactly what it comes down to. Basically, the president is given a certain amount of money from Congress to carry out the nation's deportations. Usually that comes out to about $400,000 a year, and the president has absolutely been doing that every year that he's been in office. What he is arguing and what the administration has been trying to do since he took office is focus more of those deportations on undocumented immigrants who have a extensive criminal record, who pose a threat to national security, who are members of gangs, and leave the people who are here, who are leading otherwise law-abiding lives, leave them alone. And so what the president was trying to say is, look, we make these decisions every day on who to deport and who not to, so why not create this big program to allow those people that we're not going to deport anyway to register with the federal government, get work permits, we know who they are, we know their identities, and so that's their argument, is that we're not going to deport these kind of folks anyway, so why not make it a more formalized structure? And that's what the court has ruled, is where he went a step too far.
Now, to take it sort of big picture, there's been a lot of opposition in Congress to what the GOP sees as the executive branch doing an end run around elected representatives. How has the Obama administration responded specifically to those criticisms?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it fits perfectly into this narrative of the sort of imperial presidency of Obama, if you will. They've accused him of trying to use his power too broadly on a wide variety of issues throughout his tenure. In this one, though, it's interesting because presidents have been allowed to use prosecutorial discretion for decades. Republican presidents have done it. Democratic presidents have done it. And in 2012, when President Obama created a program to protect undocumented immigrants who were brought to the country as children from deportation, that was fine. That was upheld by courts. More than 700,000 of those undocumented immigrants are now registered with the federal government. They have work permits. They're living here legally. And so it didn't seem to be that much of a problem then. But the fact that he scaled it up as big as he did, I think that's what drove a lot of people to really, you know, make those claims again of the imperial presidency. And that's why you saw 26 different Republican leaders in different states join this lawsuit to try to block it.
And what is the president said to give counterbalance to that idea you were talking about of the imperial presidency?
Yeah, I mean, he's just basically saying that, no, look, this is one of the fastest appeals to the Supreme Court I've seen in quite a while. If to hear them talk, they feel pretty confident that the law is absolutely on their side. They say that this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is pretty widely regarded as being a conservative district, and I don't think anybody was caught by surprise by today's ruling. They were pretty much expecting it. So what he's saying basically is that, no, this is, I can't deport all 11 million people here, so why am I going to So why not enact a program where the people that I'm not going to deport anyway, the people who don't pose a threat, who don't pose a crime threat, just go ahead and give them peace of mind while at the same time allowing them to work legally and contributing as they already are in this country, but in a more formalized way where they're paying taxes, where they're doing everything that the rest of us do anyway.
We're talking with Alan Gomez from USA Today right now, talking about the latest ruling on the president's executive action on immigration. Also going to be finding out what's next. So before we move on to the what's next, Alan, let's talk about what this plan would do when it was first introduced. We were talking more about those details. So refresh us what the deferred action for parents of Americans would do.
Okay, what it would have done is allowed... Well, let's go back really quick to 2012 to the program for the kids. What that did is allow them to register with the federal government, and then in exchange, they ran a criminal background check on them. They checked if they were paying their taxes.
So before we move on to the what's next, Alan, let's talk about what this plan would do when it was first introduced. We were talking more about those details. So refresh us what the deferred action for parents of Americans would do.
Okay, what it would have done is allowed... let's go back really quick to 2012 to the program for the kids. What that did is allow them to register with the federal government, and then in exchange, they ran a criminal background check on them. They checked if they were paying their taxes, things like that. And if they cleared those hurdles, then they were allowed to stay in the country for a period of 2 years without any threat of deportation, and then apply for that work permit so they can legally work here. When he extended it to this deferred action for parental arrivals, is the same exact program. Allowing them to stay, extended it to 3-year periods of protection from deportation, but then expanded the pool of people that would have been eligible. And specifically, they were looking at the undocumented immigrants who had children who were either born in the U.S., so they were U.S. citizens, or their children are legal permanent residents. And so that it would have been about 4.3 million, some estimates get it up to about 5. Basically, they would have been able to register with the government, stay here, work here, and unless they committed some major crime or anything like that, pretty much live without a fear of deportation.
So, and in the meantime, what happens with those 5 million undocumented workers?
Well, they keep waiting. I mean, it was when this plan was blocked earlier this year, it was just, I forget if it was a day or two before the program was about to start taking applications. People had their everything ready. They were getting ready to file. And so obviously now they've been left in this sort of limbo. And so that's where they stay. I mean, there was a lot of people, millions of people in this country who were incredibly hopeful that they were going to get this opportunity. And obviously now they're not going to be able to. So, get ahead of myself here, when we look at what's next, their wait could be a year to 2 years, because that's how long it may take for the Supreme Court, if they decide to take the case, to finally render a ruling on it.
Right, and we know as of today that the Department of Justice announced that it is going to file an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. So does that mean, given the issue of this magnitude, that this is guaranteed to be taken up?
I mean, it's one of these issues where it seems to fit every sort of characteristic that the Supreme Court looks for in a case. There's disagreement within different circuits at the federal court level. Definitely a matter of national importance when you consider how many people are affected and that there's pretty much people in every state who fit this category. So, I mean, I think everyone just assumes that they're going to take the case. I think it would be a really big surprise if they didn't. But the important thing here is the timing. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, they heard oral arguments 4 months ago and waited until now to release the ruling. Immigration advocates are just absolutely enraged about that. That is an incredibly long period of time. The dissenting judge in this case, it was a 2-1 ruling, and even the dissenting judge made a point of that, saying that it was inexcusable that it took as long as it did to get this out. She, basically saying they slow-walked this to delay it even more. And so what that does is it puts the administration in a very, very tight bind to try to get this before the Supreme Court before its current term ends. It's a long process. You have to file with the Supreme Court. The states that sued have to be given time to respond, and that whole process takes several months. And basically, they have to finish that before the end of this year for the Supreme Court to even consider taking it. So absolute best-case scenario right now is the Supreme Court does take it on an expedited basis, and we get a ruling sometime in summer of 2016. But if they miss that window, that's it. This thing isn't being decided until after President Obama is out of office, and we're looking at a 2017 ruling. So it could be 1 to 2 years before we finally get some resolution on this.
So, Alan, just briefly as we wrap up, which scenario here do you think is the most likely?
I mean, I think this is such a big issue, and the court has been very involved on these questions of the federal government's role in immigration enforcement. We saw it several years ago when they took up when Arizona tried to pass a state law trying to enforce immigration. So I think it's a topic that they're obviously interested in and that they recognize as one of a national importance. So I think they'll take it up, after covering courts for as long as I have, I know you can never guess with judges.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today.
The contenders for the Republican presidential nomination are gathering in Milwaukee tonight for their fourth debate. While Wisconsin often gets a lot of political attention for being a purple state, we have a deeper historical significance for the Republican Party.
According to most accounts, the Republican Party was founded in Ripon, Wisconsin, in a little white schoolhouse in March of 1854. Prior to its formation, American politics were divided between Democrats and Whigs, and the dominating issue was the status of slavery as the country expanded west.
The party was founded by a Whig and a Democrat, and it was the last time a new major party was developed. Here with us now to talk about that history is Russell Blake, professor of history at Ripon College. Russell, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you set the scene briefly? What was the American political environment like in 1854 on the eve of the creation of the Republican Party?
Well, it was a chaotic political environment. One of the two major parties, the Whig Party, was in the process of falling apart. And the country was really at loggerheads in many, many ways over the issue of slavery. That had been, since 1850, an issue that had torn parties apart and torn the sections apart.
And what was the impetus then for the people who wanted to create this new party?
Well, the immediate impetus was that in January of 1854, Democrats in Congress put forward something called the Nebraska Bill. And the Nebraska Bill was to organize the Kansas and Nebraska Territory. And the specific problem that people had with it was that it was going to allow slavery there. It was going to let the settlers of Nebraska and Kansas decide whether they wanted slavery or not. That really angered Northerners because they had expected that those territories would be open only to free state settlers and not open to slavery. So that was the immediate thing that set things going in January.
So why this key moment in Ripon, Wisconsin? What led to that schoolhouse there?
Well, after the Nebraska Bill was proposed, a prominent Democrat in town named Jedediah Bowen, who owned a hardware store, wrote a letter to the editor of the paper in which he, in very, very, very strong words, condemned what the Democrats were doing. He's a Democrat himself, but he's saying that I can no longer adhere to what my party is doing in allowing the possibility of slavery to be spread into Kansas and Nebraska. And so when that letter appeared in January in the Ripon paper, Whig leaders, in particular a man named Alvin Beauvais, who was a real estate developer, Alvin Beauvais read this and said, well, you know, Jedediah Bowen and I must agree more than I thought, even though I'm a Whig and he's a Democrat. And so they got together and they got other people together, and they found out that there was a real core of interest in Ripon to break with both political parties because they felt that neither the Whigs nor the Democrats could guarantee what they wanted most, which is to prevent the spread of slavery into the territories.
Now, a political party then wasn't what it is now, as I understand it. What did it mean to be starting a new political party in 1854?
Well, the political parties were not as nationally organized as they are now. State and local organizations of parties were much more important. There certainly wasn't the kind of party apparatus and the money and so on associated with political parties in the 20th and 21st centuries. So it was in some ways easier to start a new party. What they did was they got together at a meeting in March of 1854, and local Whig committeemen came to the meeting, and local Democratic committeemen came to the meeting, and they just said, okay, we're no longer Whigs, we're no longer Democrats, and they formed this new party.
Was there a big response at this initial meeting, a lot of political players showing up?
There were actually two meetings. There had been a really big meeting at the end of February held in a church. And at this big meeting, there were women as well as men there. There were a lot of speeches, a lot of cheering, and it was kind of a rousing 19th-century political stump meeting. And out of that came a series of resolutions which essentially said, we want to have a new party. We don't want slavery extended. The second meeting was more, I guess what you could say would be like a kind of dull committee meeting where they were just formally organizing and selecting local leaders for the new party and so on.
Talking to Russell Blake from Ripon College about the founding of the Republican Party, Wisconsin played a big role. So as you say, slavery, the slavery issue was the big impetus here. So was that a challenge? Was this seen as a single issue party? Did they have to come up with a platform on everything else going on in politics at the time?
Yeah, that the people in Ripon certainly did not. When this was going on in Ripon and lots of other places in the spring and summer of 1854, it pretty much was single issue. Now, when the party got organized at state and eventually at the national level, then, of course, they had to have a stance on the tariff and immigration issues and all sorts of other things that a political party would have to have a stand on. But it was, I don't think it's stretching to say that it was pretty much a single-issue party. The slavery issue dominated politics in the 1850s in a way that it's really hard for us to imagine now.
So 1854, they're having these initial meetings. 1860, as I recall, they're electing Abraham Lincoln president. So this thing spread fast.
It spread really fast. In the 1856 presidential election, John C. Fremont, who was the first Republican nominee for president, almost beat Buchanan, who was the Democrat and who eventually won. So, yeah, it spread very, very fast because it gathered the support in the North of former Whigs, but it also gathered the support in the North of many, many Democrats who felt that, as people did in Ripon, that the Democratic Party was no longer representing their Northern interests on the slavery issue.
Did Wisconsin stick with Republicans in those subsequent elections?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, Wisconsin was a very strong Republican state.
Did people at that time see Ripon and those meetings as a pivotal moment, as the originator of the Republican Party?
Yeah, I don't think they did immediately, that is, at the time, because there were these meetings taking place, as I said, all over the North. It was really a grassroots movement, and it was in the 1870s that it was first recognized that this thing, this Republican Party had started in Ripon. In the 1870s, a man named Henry Wilson, who had been vice president of the United States under Republican Ulysses S. Grant, Wilson wrote a history of the Republican Party, and it was Wilson that he visited Ripon while he was doing his research, and it was Wilson who said that it looked to him like the first party had been organized here in Ripon.
Looking back, we know that the country was 7 years away from a huge destructive war. Was there a feeling that this kind of calamity was just around the corner as they were founding that party?
No, I don't think so. I think that's one of the things that's kind of surprising and interesting about this whole controversy that was going on throughout the country. People were vehement that slavery not spread to the West, but I believe they felt this was all going to be settled through the regular political means. That is, that a law would be passed that said that slavery couldn't spread to the West. I don't think people anticipated war at all. It really wasn't until the war was pretty much upon people in 1860 that people believed that there would not be a political solution.
Talk a little bit about Republicans in Wisconsin and their role in that war. I understand some veterans, officers, ended up playing a big role when they came home in Wisconsin politics.
Yeah, I'm not really sure about that. I am sure that that is absolutely the case. It's interesting that many of the people that founded the party in Ripon went on to serve in the war. They were young men. Most of these men were in their 30s when they founded the party. And Alvin Beauvais, who was really instrumental in founding the party, he became an officer. And actually, when the war was over, he was given the job of kind of being the he was the general in charge of Newport News, Virginia, when it was occupied, and had a very significant role to play in the war there. So, the war service was really important for political prominence after the war.
Now, Ripon has this claim as maybe the birthplace of the Republican Party. Is that contested? Are there other places that say, no, this is where it really started?
Yeah, it's very contested. It's especially contested by Exeter, New Hampshire, and it's contested also by Jackson, Michigan. There are other places, too, but over the years, Exeter and Jackson have put forward claims.
Russell, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
We've been talking to Russell Blake, professor of history at Ripon College, about the founding of the Republican Party in Ripon, Wisconsin. Contenders for the Republican presidential nomination gather in Milwaukee tonight for their fourth debate.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A recent study from the U.S. Travel Association indicates that Americans are taking less vacation time than at any point in the last 40 years. Not only is that hurting vacation traditions, maybe also seriously affecting children.
Joining us to talk about the possible ripple effects of not using vacation time from the U.S. Travel Association is Katie Dennis, Senior Director of Project Time Off. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds like you got interested in tracking this after you saw a study about what kids were most interested in at Disneyland. What did that study find?
Well, one of the things that we wanted to look at is because we know that people aren't taking their time off, and we know that the workplace is the main reason for it, but we also wanted to know why and what was holding people back in terms of their families. Because everybody says, I want to spend that time with my family. That's really, you know, what motivates me. That's why I want to do it. So we actually wanted to talk directly to kids about what it meant to them, because we know it's important to their parents. So what we did with this study is we tried to get it, you know, directly from the horse's mouth. And what's great about kids and also terrifying is that they don't hold anything back. They don't pull any punches. You know, I think when we survey adults sometimes what we see is people want to be the best version of themselves. So they're very positive about, you know, their health, their happiness. They floss every day. But when you talk to kids, they don't hold anything back. So we got probably the most honest survey we've ever done. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit alarming. I have one child and another one due in a couple weeks. So
congrats.
For me in particular, this was something that I kind of sat up and paid attention to because it was not what I expected to see.
And
what we saw is that most kids are paying way more attention than you might think. So 6 in 7 kids say, yes, I see my parent bringing work stress home. Another 3/4 of them said, my parent's unable to disconnect when they get home from work. This was something that was a lot higher than I realized, because I think like a lot of people, I always thought there's a separation between, you know, it's church and state, right? If I'm doing work at home when other people are occupied, they're not really paying attention. It's not that big of a deal. But what we found is that it does really affect them, and not in a great way. So the importance of prioritizing that vacation time and carving out that quality time for them couldn't be more important.
So it sounds like the kids, at least at the Disneyland thing, they were interested in the phones. Their parents were looking at phones, and mm-hmm. you see the phone as sort of the conduit between work and home life, because this is how parents keep in touch with the workplace. And you found that, well, this is a statistic, that Americans are taking less vacation now than at any point in the last 40 years. So how did we get there?
So technology is a great thing in the sense that it's given us so many different opportunities. You literally can be anywhere. But I think if you look at the trend line that we studied, we've lost almost a full work week of vacation from 2000 to now. And that's something that we call America's Lost Week. And it really does follow the trend line in our adoption of technologies. We kind of expected to see a drop off around the recession and after that, and, you know, people being more fearful of losing their jobs and worried about taking vacation and money and all of the things that make a lot of intellectual sense. But what we found is it happened a lot sooner than that. So it seems like, you know, for all the great things that it gives us, it also gives us this connectivity to the office where we feel like we can't get away, because we literally can't get away. It's, you know, when we ask people what their number one fear is when it comes to taking time off, why don't they do it? It's fear of workload. And it's not, you know, it's not a myth. You can watch it happening. You can hold it in your hand and see that it is happening. Your work is piling up. There are ways to mitigate that, and that's what we would advocate for, because the benefits of taking the time off far outweigh the work that you're going to have to deal with when you get back, especially if you take the right steps in advance of, you know, coordinating with your colleagues, making sure you send reminders, doing as much as you can before you leave. All of this stuff is fairly basic, and I think intuitively we all know that. But when it comes to actual execution, we find that some people are really dropping off in their ability to prepare for that time off. And that's something that we need to work on, because it's going to make it so much better to come back to.
And one of the reasons that you're advocating for this is children. Why do children benefit from their parents taking the time off that they've got?
So one of the things with children particularly is that, and we interviewed a lot of family therapists for this to kind of weigh in on the results so that we had a little bit more perspective on them. And one of the things we heard repeatedly with the therapists we spoke with is that children need a quantity of time for quality interactions to emerge. You can't just sit a kid down and say, we're going to have 20 minutes of quality time now. It doesn't work like that. So you really kind of need the conditions to be right. And that's what vacation represents. Whether it's, you know, a long weekend or a field trip, you get that kind of time with them where those quality interactions can emerge. And that's really, really important to your relationship. And teens in particular, it's very difficult to say that, you know, shuttling from one practice to the next or to school or something like that, you're not going to get that quality time that way. And I know there's all sorts of stats about how we spend more time with our kids than at any point in history, but it's not quality time. So when we put vacations on the shelf, when we say, we'll get to it later, you know, it's one of those things that gets pushed off, we really are kind of sacrificing that quality time with our children, and that's really, really important. We had almost a quarter of parents admit that they haven't taken a family vacation in over a year.
We're talking with Katie Dennis right now with the U.S. Travel Association and Senior Director of Project Time Off. And, you know, it's not just parents who are busy. Kids are busy, too. Children have, you know, dance recitals and soccer games and kid art exhibits. Isn't it hard for parents to get to all of these things and take that time off that they might have to use to go to all of it?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a ton of activities, and I think, you know, there's been volumes written about how overscheduled kids are. And I think that's all the more reason that we do need to find those opportunities for that time to relax together. Eight in ten of the children that we studied said they were experiencing stress in their lives, which was a huge number. They have their own stress to deal with. Parents have their own stress to deal with. What we're saying is that you have to find the time, carve it out, prioritize it, plan it ahead of time. That's the hardest part, is planning. And then you're going to reap the benefits. You're going to get the quality time together. You're going to get the relationship you want. And we do have the time. I think this is something that we hear all the time. I don't have time. I don't have time. Everyone can identify with that. We're always rushing from one thing to the next, but we know that 40% of Americans aren't using the vacation time they're given. This is part of the benefits you receive. I mean, make that the time that you have. You're not creating it out of thin air, but you do have to plan it in advance. And I think that's something we can all identify with. Your calendar starts filling up. It becomes harder and harder, and then you really can't at a certain point. One of the things I did at the beginning of the year, I didn't have anything planned. So I was like, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to remedy this? And I just blocked a week in April and said, you know, kind of put my flag in the ground. That's when I'm going to be gone. And I didn't know what I was going to do. But we ended up finding something. It worked out. So it was just one of those things where everyone I worked with knew that was when I was going to be gone. And no meetings were scheduled because I had 4 months' notice, basically, before I took off. And I think that made it a lot easier. And I felt a lot better going into it because I knew I was driving to that the whole, you know, quarter, basically.
You've also said that another big impact is missing those memories and really that it's a family bonding time when there are these vacations, maybe if it's a staycation or if you go somewhere. How important are those memories to childhood?
So one of the things that we wanted to do is ask children what was their most memorable experience when their parent took time off to be with them. And what was really amazing to me is that it wasn't a big trip. It wasn't always, you know, there was plenty of mentions of Disney, don't get me wrong, but a lot of the stuff that we saw was simple things, camping, field trips, just kind of being there for different things that you wouldn't necessarily think are that big of a deal. One of my favorite comments was, there was a 14-year-old girl in Arizona, and she mentioned that her favorite time that she had with her working parent was when her dad took the day off, they went to Target, they bought a slip and slide, and they set it up in the backyard and played with it. That was her most memorable day that her parent took time off to be with her. And it really doesn't have to be a big thing. And I think that's sort of the misconception sometimes people have about vacation. They assume it's, you know, a week-long thing that has to be a big commitment. It really doesn't. I mean, you can make a weekend a long weekend. You could build a treehouse. You could do so many different things. And it all matters. And, you know, what we saw in the kids' verbatim responses is that they really do remember that stuff, and they keep score. We asked them if they could remember the last thing that their working parent missed, and yes, they can. And a lot of them, you know, you expect to see the occasional soccer game and things like that. That was in there, but mostly there were some bigger things in there, and they really did pay attention to that, like when their parent kind of checked out on vacations to go work while they were, you know, down at the beach, or a lot of mentions of the holidays, Christmas not being there, things like that. So that was kind of depressing to see, and I really hope that that's something that, you know, we can use vacation time for to prioritize and be there for those big moments, because you don't want to miss them, and you don't get them back.
Is there a case to be made that watching a parent work and work hard is instilling a good work ethic in children? You know, with the economy right now, it's recovering, but it has been shaky, and there's competition for jobs. So isn't this a good thing to see parents working hard?
Not a mutually exclusive thing from our perspective. Working hard and working smart are things that you need to prioritize, right? So one of the things that we hear a lot is that, oh, well, we're not going to be France. We don't need to be France, actually. If you look at the long-term trend line, we can just be the U.S. 15 years ago. We seem to have transformed our storied American work ethic into this work martyrdom. And now there's this assumption that we've always been like that, but we really haven't. What worries me the most is when I see that trend line of us, you know, using a week less time in less than 15 years, I'm curious, as we're setting up this expectation for our kids that the way that we work, you know, bringing home stress, not disconnecting, we're not only saying that it's acceptable, we're kind of creating a new norm out of that. And that, to me, is the biggest thing to be fearful of, because that trend line is going to just keep going down, and it really could be the disappearing family vacation.
We're talking to Katie Dennis right now, Senior Director of Project Time Off. She's with the U.S. Travel Association. We're looking at the impacts of not using vacation time, what that might do to children.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you think Americans have a hard time taking vacation time? What are some of the obstacles? Is it hard for you to get time off with your family? We'd love to hear your firsthand experience with this issue. Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234.
We continue our conversation now with Katie Dennis, Senior Director of the U.S. Travel Association's Project Time Off, and we're looking at how kids are affected by their parents' unused vacation time.
And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How does this play out at your workplace and in your family? Is it a struggle to get vacation time, even vacation time that's part of your compensation package? Do you have trouble making time for that family trip or that family day? And do you see your kids missing out on this? Do you see them eyeing you when you're making that phone call when you are off of work? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take our first caller now. We have Simon with us in Delafield. Simon, hi.
Hi. You know, one of the things, first of all, I want to be clear that I love teachers. Actually, I teach myself at the college level. But there seems to be a growing trend, at least where my daughters go to school, that kids are expected to do homework 7 days a week, that they're expected to be doing some type of homework on Saturdays and Sundays. And I have a real problem with that, because I think one of the things we need to educate our kids on is how to be able to take a break from work. But to be going at it 7 days a week, I personally think is very unhealthy.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts on that, Simon. And Katie, this is, again, coming at it from not so much the parent, but the children's perspective. The parents maybe say they like to spend time with their kids, but the kids are busy doing homework. Have you looked at it from that angle?
Well, I think one of the things that we are really concerned about is that we are raising the next generation of work martyrs. And, you know, not only by the example we're setting as working parents, but also in the sense that there are a lot of expectations on kids now that, you know, you can argue whether they're reasonable or not, and I'm sure it depends on where you live and where you go to school and all those different things. But I will say, when we ask children how they, what their mood is like, just 19% say in their regular lives they're in a very good mood. It shoots up to 60% when their parent takes time off from work and they get to spend it together. So the moods are really important, and I think that's also going to feed into your general happiness and how much you're willing to do. I'm willing to bet that it's not that different from a productivity standpoint. We've seen time and time again that people who take time off, they're happier, they're more productive, they're more creative because they get to kind of break out of that daily mold. I'm sure that's true with children as well. If they get the chance, they get to kind of reset, recharge, and probably come back with some new ideas and ways of thinking, you know, to bring to their education.
Well, thanks a lot, Simon. Appreciate that call. We go next to Mike joining us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi. I had two comments. One of them was that I have a relatively stressful job that, you know, if I take a whole week off, then I come back and I'm even double stressed because now I'm spending a lot of time trying to catch up on projects that didn't necessarily have someone else doing my work for me while I was gone. But then my second point was that, you know, I have four kids at home that I really want to be home for. So my kind of compromise has been lately that I at least try to be home before they get home, at least a couple days a week, instead of working late. So I guess maybe does it help to just at least compromise a little bit.
And, Mike, how do you do that? Do you just go to work extra early on those days you get home early?
Generally, yes.
Okay, so you might be a little tired, but you're home. All right, thanks a lot for that. And Mike's tip talking about making some incremental changes there to his schedule. What do you think about that, Candy? And also, can you talk a little bit more about how to balance the work when your work is stressful? Maybe you go away and you come back to more stress.
Sure. I think most of the people that we've surveyed, everyone feels work stress. You know, that's certainly not unique. And I know I do, and my job is to tell people to take vacations. So we're, you know, no one is immune to that, absolutely. But, you know, you have to do what's manageable for you. If a week of vacation is going to make you feel more stressed out, then that's not really helpful because that's not doing much for you. If your kids are going to sense that stress, you know, it's not good for your health or your happiness if that's going to make you feel worse. So find what does work for you. You know, you're coming home earlier to spend more time with your kids. That's great. Maybe it's just a matter of taking a Friday off and doing something that, you know, you don't usually do. Go hiking. Go. One of the things that we did this year is we decided to explore the Pacific Northwest and did a road trip that was from Seattle to Portland. And if you're a geography whiz, that's only a 3-hour drive, but we did it in 5 days. So it was one of those. We turned a weekend into a longer weekend and got to see all sorts of really great things. And if you live in one of those cities, everything we did is no more than a 3-hour drive. So from, you know, going to Pike Place Market to hiking in the Olympic National Park to, you know, going through Oregon wine country, all of that stuff was very within reach. You could do any one of those things in a single day. So it's just making the time work for you. You know, it shouldn't be a chore, but there's a lot of things that you can do. And a day or two is a really great thing. And it doesn't have to be a full week. That's not always possible. And, you know, we want to be realists, but you also want to take advantage of the benefits you're given.
We're talking right now with Katie Dennis with the U.S. Travel Association's Project Time Off. And we're talking about what can happen in the family, especially the family dynamic with children, when their parents don't take all of their allotted time off. And we have room right now for your call. What about you? Do you tend to take all of your given vacation? And if you don't, why don't you take it? Do you think that it does have an impact on your family life? Do you think your kids notice, or does it sort of fly over their heads? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Katie, you said that the kids notice when their parents aren't there, when their kids should be present at, say, a family holiday, but instead they're doing work somewhere. How understanding are kids of the pressures that parents are under and why they might have to work when they're at home with their family?
So the good news is kids are very understanding of this. Much like adults, you know, nearly 9 in 10 kids say they understand when, you know, work emergencies pop up. I think what happens, and what our therapist told us that we interviewed for this report, is that when those work emergencies become regular, then you're changing the pattern. And when that pattern starts to shift is when the real disappointment sets in. Kids do feel the disappointment a little more acutely than adults. You know, we talked to couples about this, and 1 in 3 said, yeah, we argue over time for work versus time for each other. 6 in 10 kids say they're upset when their parents prioritize work over time with them. So they do feel that a little bit more acutely, although they are very understanding. And I will say, as a mom myself, a lot of this is really hard to read. But when we talk to parents about the grades they give themselves spending time with their kids, only 28% gave themselves an A. We're very hard on ourselves. Kids are much nicer. 46% of them gave their parents an A grade. So, you know, as much as it's one of those things that you really want to be cognizant of it, aware of their feelings, aware of some of these dynamics, and do what you can to improve your own family situation, however fits for you, there's a lot of room here, and kids can be very forgiving. So there's room to improve.
So there's hope.
You know, if you've never done it, it's all over.
All right. Well, let's go back to our callers. We've got Stephen on the line from Nora, Illinois. Stephen, hello.
Hello. How are you, ladies, today?
Good, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to point out that sometimes it's not the easiest thing in the world to have both parties involved when you have, you know, two working parents. I have a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old. And she's a nurse. I'm in media. So to get that together, usually we get a 3-day weekend, and we use that as a holiday. And we usually do that to travel for family purposes, you know, visiting grandma out of state or so on and so forth. And then, of course, to get that time together, you have your home duties as well as work duties. So the stress is also there. So sometimes you have to lax on maybe some of the home duties like laundry or something for the day to make time for the children.
Got it. Thank you so much, Stephen. And you're going to have the last word on this conversation. I know Katie agrees and thinks that we should be taking time off. It is a hard thing to do. Katie, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Katie Dennis. She's with the U.S. Travel Association's Project Time Off. And we've been talking about the ripple effect that may happen with children in the home and the family life when all of that vacation time is not used, when some of it's left on the table. Today is the 40th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It went down in a November storm in Lake Superior. And we'll hear more about the wreck, the storm, all of that tomorrow on the show. But one reason that the tragedy lives on so strongly even today is the song that it inspired.
Canadian singer-songwriter Gordon Lightfoot released the song The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald the following year, inspired by a Newsweek article on the sinking and by his own love of boating on the Great Lakes.
The song hit number 2 on the Billboard charts here in the U.S. and number 1 in Lightfoot's home country of Canada. And it's kept the wreck in popular memory ever since, along with the mystery of what exactly happened on that day in November.
Yesterday, Lightfoot met with family members of the crew at the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum in Paradise, Michigan in the Upper Peninsula as part of the anniversary commemoration. The museum's collection includes the bell from the Edmund Fitzgerald and a wing devoted to artifacts related to the wreck.
So here is that song, starting with the ship's departure from Superior, Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling?